Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Hope everyone had a wonderful Labor Day weekend. I know lots to celebrate. Lots and lots. This is one of those Labor Days where I go, it's our 18th anniversary. We've been doing this show now 18 years. Never thought it would last this long. In fact, told at the beginning we wouldn't make it 6 months. So, as someone reminded me, I do this. I continue out of spite. And I've proved that person wrong, 36 consecutive times in a row. But this Labor Day, a little bit different. Outside of the celebration of the big program succeeding another 6 months, this was something to really celebrate. I mean, and the weird thing is I had one of these weird back and forth conversations about Joe Biden and his policies, and someone told me, I deserve everything that crook is going to give you. And I said, yeah, I do deserve everything that the administration does. I do. We all do. And thank goodness for that. Thank goodness for the Biden administration this Labor Day. And working people should be grateful. And this is one of those things where I said, you can just say thank you. It's that simple. Just say thank you, because going to make lives so much better. And as I said, what a Labor Day 2023 was. Something to actually celebrate, because labor law, it's a changing. And, because as we've been talking about for the last several days, the administration is doing the stuff that I've been calling for all of the 18 years I've been doing this. Because what's happened is that there's been an all-out assault by Republicans and conservative corporate Democrats on working people. Now, and I say it all the time, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. This administration is turning the tide on that. And as we've been talking about the last several days, the National Labor Relations Act is moving back towards the original intent, what I've been calling for. Because understand, the original, that thing that they passed back in the 1930s, that gave employers no rights whatsoever. None. As a lawyer friend loves to tell me, there isn't a paragraph in the NLRA that has any rights for employers. There isn't a sentence. There isn't a phrase. There isn't a word. There's nothing in it. Nothing. Because what they understood at the beginning is employers had all the rights, all of the control, all of the power. And what the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, meant to do was not level the playing field, but somewhat give workers a little bump forward so that they could fight for better wages, hours, and conditions and help grow an economy. And it did an amazing, amazing job. It was the one tool that my grandparents' generation used to build the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. Did it very well, which is why conservatives, 1947, over the veto of Harry Truman, passed Taft-Hartley, which created out of whole cloth this no rights at work agenda, which then, began turning the tide. And we're in a moment right now where this administration saying, no, I think we need to give workers a little bit of an opportunity, encourage and enable workers to bargain collectively for those better wages, hours, conditions. And, we've been talking about this CMEX case, which is potentially a massive, massive game changer. So this Labor Day, perfect time, celebrate this moment. Something to be extremely excited about, something to celebrate. not just the end of summer, not just the last days at the swimming pool. Did that stuff. Yes, absolutely. Hope everyone had a wonderful time. But actually fundamental change. And, you know, as I said over the weekend, this is the most fundamental positive labor change of my lifetime. This is, to steal a Joe Biden, this is a big freaking deal. And, you know, not just this, they've also sped up, they're also moving to speed up elections so that employers don't have the ability to harass and intimidate and fire, do all the things that they've been accustomed to being able to get away with while simultaneously protecting workers in the workplace. This, the most pro-worker administration of my lifetime, some would argue ever. I'm going to go FDR forever, but this is a close second. This is moving in that direction. And what did we get from the right wing? What did we hear all weekend? No, thank you, Mr. President. No, thank you for helping to bring the economy back from the brink. No, thank you, Mr. President, for dealing with supply chain issues. No, thank you, Mr. President, for helping bring down inflation. No, none of that. I was watching Mitch McConnell give a speech on the Senate floor today, and he came back and he wanted to do allay any fears that he's losing his mind or having anything. And, you know, he did his little song and dance about how he was during the break all over Kentucky, you know, eating hot dogs or doing whatever he was doing. He named a bunch of cities. He said a bunch of things, but there was one line that grabbed my attention, because the rest of it was all just nonsense. It was just, you know, filibustering, you know, for the sake of there were words, basically. He could say words. Hey, God, he could say words. But he said, you know, when he was talking to people, like at the fair, because they have, I guess, the best hamburgers, supposedly, in Kentucky at this particular fair, which, I got to be honest, I'm pro-hamburger, wouldn't mind trying it. But he said, and I quote, that the people that he talked to said that there is too much government and not enough being done to address the economy. And, you know, I'm sitting here and I said, he didn't actually just say that, did he? That's not the message, is it? So I went back and I bumped it back a little bit, replayed it again. And sure enough, there's too much government and not enough being done to address the economy. And I'm going, how is it that you can say something that in one sentence that is the polar opposite of what the first part is? And look, you know, I know, they're Republicans. It's what they do. It's like, you know, the right to bear arms should not be infringed, but well-regulated militia we forgot about. But I look at this and this kind of thought process, there's too much government, but government's not doing enough, is kind of weird. And it goes into this place where I recently had a back and forth with a guy who said that everyone in the country is sometimes communist. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know that I agree with that. And his argument was when bad things happen, they want the community, the state, they want the federal government, the local government, they want all of this assistance, and they don't want to have to do anything for it. They then want, you know, government to take responsibility. And I go, I guess in that vein, I might tend to lean possibly. But no, that's not what this is about. Now, again, I go back to, what did we hear from the right-wing message machine? It blew my mind that I'm hearing about drag shows again. I'm hearing about Obama again. Evidently, we're back to Obama's gay. And I'm just going, why now? Why is this a thing now? And then I'm going, you know, am I going to start hearing about tan suits and Muslim prayer rugs and terrorist fist bumps again? Are we going that far back? Is Beergate coming back? Are they that desperate to shield themselves from the little that they have to offer that they've got to drag up the golden oldies to keep people completely blinded by the fact that they've got nothing to offer? Now, here's the thing. This is the important part. And the reason I brought up the Mitch McConnell thing. They're saying there's too much government, but government's not doing enough. You're not doing enough to address the economy. What is the Republican plan to address the economy? Well, the first part, there's too much government. Don't do anything. That's their argument. Should do nothing. Leave it to the invisible man with the invisible plan and the invisible ideas who take real money out of your pocket and mine. And this is just it. I guess I just I'm struggling. And what they're offering. Because I wish they were a functional party. I do. I wish the Republicans were a functional party. I wish we could actually get something done that would move us forward. Look, Biden's killing it with what he has to work with. He's killing it, but all we keep hearing, Biden's too old. Yeah, he's old. And he's still killing it. He's still doing really, really good things. In the face of all of this idiocy raging, there is nothing coming from the Republican Party. Nothing. And this is where I'm concerned, because their followers, the F. Joe Biden crowd, which I've heard a lot over the last couple of days. I then turn it and go, okay, well, what do you think, Ramaswamy or Christie or Haley or, 45, cult 45 himself. What do you think they're going to do? What's the agenda? What are they going to bring us? What's the plan? And there isn't one. And the weird thing is they don't want one. They just want anger, because that's what's being spoon-fed. And that's where the sane and rational in our community have got to come back around and go, well, wait a second. Things are moving in the right direction. Are they perfect? No, they're never perfect. We've always got problems. We've always got things we need to address. But do I want someone who's willing to help possibly address those things and listen to what we're saying? Because understand, one of the knocks against Biden is, he did all that stuff back in the 90s. That's the antithesis of what he's doing now. He's responsible. Yeah, he listened. He's capable of learning. What do we get from Trump? Trump has come forth and said, he's looking for vengeance. He wants retribution. Not how he's going to make your life better. Not how he's going to make your kids' school better. Not how he's going to make healthcare more affordable. Not how he's going to make college tuition more affordable. Not how he's going to bring manufacturing jobs back or anything. It's all about him. And this is the frustrating place that we should all be concerned about. Because, we still want things for our kids. We still want opportunities for the future. We want a better economy. And this is where, the Janus face kind of, statement of Mitch McConnell of there's too much government, but you're not doing anything. People want action. People want good governance. And when you have one party, the Republicans, who are all about destroying government, you got to wonder, why do people vote for them? Because the outrage machine, they're doing their job effectively. And that's where you and I, that's where all of us have to step forward and speak up. And in these moments, when they start bashing Biden over his policies, go, it's just easier to say thank you, because it's going to help you and your family. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Got lots to get to, lots to talk about. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So let the fun begin. Marjorie Three Names had a... I wasn't going to. I wasn't going to play this clip because it's too easy. I mean, it's too easy. It's too easy to go after Marjorie Three Names. But there's this clip out here, man. And it's one of these things that you just go, what exactly is she thinking? What exactly is she talking about? So she's talking about climate change. You know, again, you've got Republicans who think, you know, it's all a big hoax. We're wasting all this money on dealing with climate change. But this is Marjorie Taylor Greene's statement during a congressional hearing. Here it is.
Are not affecting climate change. You're going to tell me that back in the Ice Age, how much taxes did people pay and how many changes did governments make to melt the ice? The climate is going to continue to change. And there is no reason to just open up our borders and allow everyone in and continue to funnel over $50 billion or however many billions of dollars or trillions of dollars to foreign countries all over the world simply because they don't like the climate change.
She is such an idiot. But here's the thing. It's a good question, valid question. She's just asking questions. You know, this is an important question. She's just asking questions here, guys. Just asking the question, you know, how much did people pay back during the Ice Age in taxes? What was the top marginal tax rate during the Ice Age? And did governments melt the ice? Was it government who melted the ice during the Ice Age? Oh. Please help me. This is why. See, again, this is why they're trying to destroy public education. So that you go, whoa, wow, that must be what happens. Wow. I'm going to guess, what do you think the tax rate would be during the Ice Age? You know, Joe Biden, in fact, it was Joe Biden's tax code. That's what it was. It was Joe Biden's tax code back during the Ice Age. And it was his policies back then that melted the ice. Let's go to the phones. Got Steve on line one. Steve, how are we doing?
Fine, thank you. And yes, I mean, if it weren't so sad, it would be funny. But the idea that this woman is a congressperson in the United States, I mean, it's just beyond belief. And she's divorced from this reality even more so than the rest of her party. I mean, the unofficial Republican line is that, okay, we concede that, you know, climate change is taking place and that human beings have something to do with it, possibly a significant part of it. But what are we going to do? Go back to living in the Stone Age? That's their sort of unofficial line. Her line is some ridiculous idea of when, you know, there were about 20,000 people on the damn planet, you know, as if they were making it possible for climate change to happen. No, Marjorie Taylor Greene, this is a phenomenon of the Industrial Revolution on, and CO2 gases have a cumulative effect, meaning that the carbon monoxide that's in the air currently that's helping to contribute to global warming has been there possibly as long as 200 years. Because that's how long it takes to sequester naturally, because that's what happens, you know, CO2, we burn fossil fuels, we emit greenhouse gases, including CO2, they end up in the atmosphere, and through a natural process, after a couple of hundred years, they then are sequestered naturally. But what we've done is, we're doing things that are placing the world in an imbalanced state, whereby we're pumping in far more CO2 gases into the atmosphere that can be naturally sequestered through this process. And as a result of which, our planet is getting warmer more quickly than it has ever in human existence. You have to go back to a period in time before human beings existed to find warming on this scale, this quickly. So, I mean, again, this is why, you know, we really do need to think about how much money we're investing in primary and secondary education. Because this is not something that requires an advanced degree to understand. But again, this woman is a congressperson in this country, and this is her level of understanding. You could literally Wikipedia this nonsense and come up with a better explanation than what she has managed to articulate here. But again, I am just baffled. And the rest of the world laughs at us when the Lauren Boberts and the Marjorie Taylor Greens and others, the Jim Jordans, open their mouths. You know, the Western Europe is just sitting there scratching their heads. How in heaven's name did they get to be the wealthiest country in the world? And I can't blame them.
I can't either. You did that segment better than I could have. Because you're spot on right. I mean, this is the sad reality of this is where we are. And what's scary is the number of people who take what she says as gospel.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, literally, there are people, especially in her part of the country, that just simply believe that, no, this can't be happening because the only one who's empowered to change the climate is God. I mean, this is what they're hearing from their pulpit, you know, at their churches on Sundays. And so, therefore, you know, all of those people who were telling him something differently, you know, those crazy people with the degrees who actually went out and did the research, you know, now they're part of some, you know, socialist plot to unseat the United States in terms of its economic standing in the world and create some sort of global socialist utopia. And climate, and this is all a giant conspiracy to forward that end. I mean, this is where these people live.
You know, you hit something here a second ago. You're a smart guy. You work in the university setting, I believe. You're someone who knows what research is. Does it bug you as much as it does me to hear people who, you know, barely got out of high school telling everyone on any issue, whether it's COVID, whether it's climate, whatever it is, just do your own research, and that research consists of watching a YouTube video? Does that drive you as crazy as it does me?
Oh, absolutely. In a free society, anyone is free to discuss almost anything that they want. We have a few limitations, but beyond that, you're free to do so. But I will ask people this, I'll offer this proposition. If you have a pain in your chest and you jump into an Uber and ask them to take you to the nearest hospital, what the Uber driver thinks about that pain in your chest is an opinion in a free society. What the head of cardiology at the University of Chicago thinks about that pain in your chest is an authoritative opinion. And that's an important distinction. Nobody in their right mind would get medical advice or legal advice from some idiot with a YouTube channel. But, well, I should take that back. There probably are a few who might. But when it comes to public policy, science, anything else, they're just willing to take the word of any idiot who manages to have, you know, a following. You know, there was a time when Alex Jones had more followers than a lot of the major cable networks that were tasked with giving people the actual journalism in a free society. So, I mean, it says a lot that so many people in this country are willing to believe just crazy because they can. And they equate Alex Jones and his ilk with the New York Times. New York Times isn't always right. But they make a real effort at hiring, I don't know, people with journalism degrees, editors, people who know something about how to disseminate facts, how to actually get facts, and what to print and what not to print in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and maybe how to spell. Or use spell check. But Steve, I appreciate the thoughts. Spot on. I'm with you 100% there. I love that. No, but here, this is the thing, and you know, he's so spot on that. You know, we have elevated people who won a popularity contest to, you know, somehow thinking that they know something. And I look at Green, I look at Boebert, I look at some of the, you know, I look at, you know, Gates, I look at some of these people. And look, there's some folks on the Democratic side too that you go, you did know Hawaii wasn't going to tip over. I mean, come on. But you know, there's a moment where you go, can't we do better? We're a country of what, 340 million people? Is Marjorie three names? Is that the best we can do? Georgia, is that the best you can do? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Got lots more to get to. Right back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I've been following some of the stories coming out of China with regards to their economy. Now, what's weird, again, I go back to the Mitch McConnell quote. You know, people say there's too much government, but the government's not doing enough on the economy, which is, again, a very weird statement. Our economy is nowhere near in as bad a shape as what we're seeing coming out of China. And the question is, what happens? What happens if China goes belly up? What happens if they go into economic chaos? What does it mean for us? What's it mean for the rest of the world? That's why I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey Rick, great to be with you.
So I'm reading this article. It says the yuan has fallen like 5% to the dollar over the last couple of months. Growth is slow. Interest rates are lowering. All this stuff's going on. What does it mean?
Yeah. There's a whole lot of people trying to figure that out, right? Because it's a little bit opaque because the Chinese government does control so much of the economy and only gives out kind of selective information. So you have to surmise some of this. But it's fair to say this, that in general, China's model of economic development is heavy on industrial production and light on consumption. And part of the reason is because so many of the billion plus people there save money because there's not a reliable pension system. You know, could the Communist Party take it away at some point in time? And so there's not a lot of internal consumption like we have that tends to drive the economy. So it gets shifted into things like industrial production that is then exported in terms of products to the United States and other markets that has effects for us that we can talk about too. Some of that they'll try to prop up the economy through real estate bubbles and construction. And there's a big Chinese real estate company that's teetering on the brink of bankruptcy that would, you know, could potentially have like Lehman Brothers type effects, what have you. But the bottom line is that China's population growth has come to a screeching halt. I mean, they don't have any immigration coming into the country. No one's moving into China actively. Why would they, really?
Right.
But and the birth rate is exceptionally low. And so they're suffering from what looks like decades of what's going to be slower growth than they need. And this is going to be a big struggle for the Chinese government to try to work through this. But what has happened in the past, Rick, when we've seen a crisis like this, and I think we'll want to talk about this, is that the Chinese government response is to export as much pain as possible. So if they have excess steel, they'll try to find a market for it. And that means the steel mills here shut down, or other types of products as well. And so we have to, you know, get our kind of what I would call trade radars up to be watching for a lot of this, because it could have very negative effects for the U.S. economy, which just, by the way, is doing quite well. And even if people are saying, I'm not feeling it yet, I mean, the data, you know, is good. The inflation rate is coming down. Wages have been, you know, we've seen some pretty healthy growth. The unemployment rate is exceptionally low. If you want to make a job transition right now, it's a great time to do it. So and in fact, in terms of the global economy, we're basically leading the pack right now. And of course, if you are watching Fox News, you're never going to expect that.
Yeah, because I was going to have you say that again, because, you know, everybody I talked to, oh, the economy's terrible. You know, I just bought this brand new TV or this brand new car, or I got all this stuff, but the economy's still terrible. You know, it's the weirdest kind of dynamic that we're in right now.
Yeah, it really is. And again, part of it is because it's been so politicized. Part of it is because inflation was up for a while because of the pandemic and other
and corporate,
you know,
greed.
Chains. Yeah. So and corporate greed. I was just going to say that is that if you know, you can factor out all of this other stuff, and corporate profits have been quite healthy. And so it's not like this is a Biden made kind of inflation-based economy. This is a good economy where there are lots of job opportunities and good job opportunities for folks. And it's, I mean, you and I both know this. You can't always say that. In fact, there's lots of times where you can't say that at all.
Right.
So we're in a far different situation than China.
Yeah, China's in trouble. How much of it is how much of this is COVID? How much of this was going to happen anyway because of their one China policy and the fact that demographically they're upside down. They've got more older people than they have younger people. I mean, we're in kind of a weird spot too, that we've got a lot of older people and not as many, but nowhere in the trouble that the places like China are in.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think there are a couple of long-term and short-term reasons for this. You know, the longer-term reasons were what I talked about before, just in terms of like how China's economic growth is produced. The other long-term impact was the one-child policy that has helped to bring down the working age population significantly over time, and you're never going to recover from that, at least over the course of the next generation. And then the short-term impetus, China had the zero COVID policy where everything was locked down and nothing was happening, and then they opened it wide open, and that didn't work either. And part of the reason is because while again, China's still a very large economy, second largest economy in the world behind the United States. China exports a lot of products and it still is growing. I mean, it still has growth. It's not shrinking, but it's just growing at a slower rate. But I think one of the fundamental issues is that Xi Jinping has really is trying to alter the course of the Chinese economy to make sure that they're growing Chinese firms and not multinational firms, and that the state is gradually controlling more and more of the economy. And that's certainly having an impact on the kind of investment that China's been able to attract.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Scott Paul. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do there. Now, as you said a second ago, that, you know, clearly, and I think everyone knows what China's model is. They overproduce and then they pump and dump. And one of their favorite dumping spots has been here in the U.S. And I just saw a story about EVs coming into the country. And I guess, the first ones are landing. In an attempt to, I would assume, corner that market and basically destroy the manufacturing that a lot of us are hoping are the future of middle class employment in this country. Is there a way to stop this? Is there things in place? How do you see this playing out?
Yeah, and we may need to take some additional steps because I do think that a Chinese entry into the American auto sector is incredibly dangerous. The auto sector is the heart of American manufacturing. And you think of all the industries that feed in to auto manufacturing, glass, steel, aluminum, rubber, all the auto parts. It's a web that stretches all across the United States. And the problem is that China's had such a head start on this EV production because of the massive amount of subsidies, which, by the way, are more than the United States could ever, that we would ever even consider, much less put into law. They have companies that have been churning out EVs for a number of years now, and one in particular, Polestar, which is the Chinese company that actually bought Volvo as well, is selling Chinese-made electric vehicles in the United States, and I see some around here, in the Washington D.C. area, and they're going to open up, I think, something like 30 or 40 retail locations, which obviously is not as many as Tesla has or the traditional dealerships have, but still, that's a beachhead, and that's a concern. And we know that those cars have to be massively subsidized by the Chinese government. Because, the United States, we already, first of all, we do have some tariffs against Chinese products that should impact the price of the Polestars. Those Polestars aren't eligible for the $7,500 tax credit because they're not made in America. And so that company will get none of the subsidies. But it's concerning that they're able to sell at the price point they are because of those subsidies.
And the cheap labor and the potential slave labor. I mean, there's a lot of things here. But what do you say to the person, Scott, who goes, well, if we're going to move towards EV, this is a good way to get the poor and the working class to be able to afford them. So we're just going to take advantage of their crisis and help folks at the bottom end of the spectrum get these cheap Chinese electric vehicles.
Yeah, well, ultimately, a lot of folks are going to be without jobs, so no one's going to have vehicles. And I think that's what the challenge is that it's better to take our time and do this right and to be able to scale up. And I do think that, you know, once you get EV sales of things like SUVs and pickup trucks, where there's the higher margins for the automakers, that they'll be able to move into the more affordable models, and that $7,500 tax credit is obviously going to be enormously helpful as well. But I think it would be incredibly defeatist to lean on Chinese autos to try to drive us into an EV future here. That would be the wrong path to take. And you're right, the supply chain, some of it is built on slave labor. And a lot of it's built on exploited labor, and it has been put together with subsidies, and they'll be able to sell the cars in the United States, at an artificially low cost. And that will, we've seen this in other industries and what happens to it. And so in a lot of ways, the auto industry is like the main artery of the manufacturing ecosystem in the United States, and so an attack on that would have a very, very detrimental impact on a lot of communities, on a lot of industries. And I am fine, Chinese companies selling their automobiles in China, they'll be able to sell hundreds of millions of those automobiles. That is awesome.
Yeah.
The U.S. market ought to be supplied by companies that are committed to workers' rights, human rights, and those cars to get the subsidies should be made in America, too.
Well, I say all the time, I'm a firm supporter of domestic production for domestic consumption. Trade should be those things that we cannot individually as a country make. Go back to, the Adam Smith stuff, and the things that he chose to use as trade were things that were unique to those countries. Anyone can make T-shirts, anyone can make cars, anyone can make widgets and whatnots. It then comes down to, who's doing it, with massive subsidies, as you pointed out, or slave labor. I don't think we want to compete in that world.
Yeah, and we can't. I mean, it's just not feasible, even with a ton of innovation or way more productivity, and efficiency. You just can't do it. And we've seen what has happened to industry after industry in the United States when we have opened that door, which is why, unfortunately, I think we got to slam it shut, because I don't see any of these Chinese companies like changing behavior or the Chinese government changing behavior, and it would be foolish. And so I'm hopeful, and this is, that yes, we want to reach these climate goals and we do want to electrify vehicles, but let's do it the right way.
Yeah.
Let's make sure that it's going to be sustainable, and that we're going to do it in a way as that we're making this transition, which obviously, Rick, and this, will have, disruptive effects for folks who are making combustion engines, right? We need to make sure that that is a just transition to making those EVs that are good jobs at good wages, and that we're not importing the stuff and wrecking our communities yet again. That would be a stupid, stupid mistake.
Yet again. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because this, obviously, the Alliance for American Manufacturing is nonpartisan, non-political, and I recognize that, and I'm not asking you to choose sides, but this is a political issue.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this should be, and I'm always looking for that thing that unifies the country, that pulls us back together. This should be one of those things that pulls us back together and says, no, we do want to make things here. We want to build stuff. We want Made in America. We want to make sure that the things that we buy are made by our neighbors or even ourselves. Do you see this as potentially in this presidential election something that both parties agree on? Do you see this as a partisan issue? Where do you see this going?
Yeah. Yeah. The answer is going to be unsatisfying, Rick, is that it's complicated. And part of it is because, you know, there should be Republicans who support EVs because, you know, some of the EV investment has been in Republican states, right? I mean, Ford's building a 6,000 person like factory outside of Memphis, Tennessee. And so if you're a politician from, you know, Western Tennessee, are you really going to say this is a terrible idea to have 6,000 jobs here?
Yeah.
And so I think it's going to be tough for them. But yeah, I mean, some Republicans want to make an EV like, you know, one of these culture issues. And it's just stupid for them to do that. And they might get a few applause lines or whatever, but we can't afford to do that. And we need to be leaders in all of this. And voters should understand that these investments are coming to red states and blue states and everywhere. And so, I'll tell you this, as someone who owns a Chevy Volt, it's great not having to pay for gas. I mean, it is really, it's a great feeling. And so once somebody from any political stripe gets used to that, you don't want to give that up.
No, it's one of those things I've been saying. We have the ability to create a future that you can be off the grid. You can. I don't know why we don't have policies that, you know, solar panels, geothermal in your homes, so that you're energy independent in each individual home, not having these massive grids that we have to support. I don't know why we're not moving in those directions. Bad policy, I don't know, but there's opportunity here. And I still think there's opportunity to bring people back together. And hopefully this will be one of those issues. But Scott, as always, I appreciate the time and the good information.
Of course, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, our good friend Scott Paul. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. And take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around.
Are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1882. That was the day that the first Labor Day celebration and parade took place in New York City. The New York Sun printed a vivid report of the parade of 10,000 marching workers. The paper described, quote, men wearing regalia, men with society aprons, and men with flags, musical instruments, badges, and all the other paraphernalia of a procession. The article went on to say, quote, as far ahead as one could see, and as far down the side streets as forms and faces could be distinguished, the windows and roofs and even the lampposts and awning frames were occupied by persons anxious to get a good view of the first parade in New York of working men of all trades united in one organization. All along the line, cheers were sent up. The reporter described the colorful banners carried by each trade union and noted that following the bricklayers came, quote, two decorated wagons containing brick arches. On each side of one of the wagons were the inscriptions 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for recreation. And, get on to it, the union will never surrender. From New York, the idea of setting aside a holiday for workers spread. Oregon became the first state to officially recognize the holiday in 1897. Colorado, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York established a Labor Day that year as well. By 1894, 23 more states celebrated the workers' holiday. It was that year that President Grover Cleveland declared it a national holiday in response to the Pullman strike and boycott that began in Chicago. Labor Day is the day to honor the sacrifices made by labor fighting for safe and fair workplaces.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So you may remember last week I was talking about wage theft. And, you know, I had a couple of people remind me that there are tons of stories out there of wage theft and all of the statistics. And I got a bunch of emails on that, and I was grateful. But this story popped up from Missouri, the Show Me State, and they're going to show us wage theft. A state senator there who basically he rose to prominence because of COVID, because he was going to defy that pandemic stuff. Well, he's being sued right now by an employee who he alleges he was cheated out of overtime pay and fired. Now, I said, you know, last week, I go, you know, the reality is the reason most people don't fight wage theft claims is because, well, most workers don't have the protection of a union and don't have the ability to stand up and fight back. Because what then happens is, yeah, you may file a claim and you may win the $50, but down the road, they're just going to fire you because you're in trouble. Well, this is what happened here. Evidently, Missouri State Senator Ben Brown owned a restaurant, and the restaurant you know, got some attention because of the pandemic stuff. But one of his employees said, hey, look, I've been working for you more than 40 hours and you haven't been paying me overtime. He brought it to their attention, said, hey, you haven't been paying me overtime. Pointed out that he was paid with a handwritten check instead of an actual paycheck so that you could track the hours, because that's part of the law. If you hire someone, there has to be a pay stub that lays out what the hours, what the wages, what the taxes, all that stuff is. And so he said, hey, you know, I want this done. He realized wasn't included in his pay, asked management about it. He was fired. And you go, wait a second, can you do that? Well, yeah, at will state most of the time. But this worker then filed a lawsuit for the back wages and what he is calling breach of contract. Now, I don't know anything about the firing. The firing could be under the grounds of, hey, you didn't come to work, whatever they can make up, because employers do this a lot. But I just think it's so fitting that I just talked about this. And here, well, a good God-fearing Republican state senator from Missouri showing us the way on how to be a, well, wage thieving employer. So we'll see how this plays out. Now, hey, it was holiday weekend. Hope you had a good holiday and hope you had some family and friends over, did the burgers and fries and all that stuff. Mother Jones had an article not too long ago that pointed out that, hey, if you had any of that stuff, anything, you know, any of that food stuff, chances are child labor was at the heart of it, because evidently our food sector, congratulations, farmers, you are the ones that violate child labor laws the most often. And, you know, they point out that, you know, a number of states are going and trying to change child labor laws because we need cheap labor. We need exploitable labor. And I find it, this is one of those things I find really interesting, because there was another story from Florida that said, hey, you know, these small scale farmers who have been heavily dependent on immigrant labor coming through with the waves of, you know, the crop waves, they are not planting as many crops, not as many winter fruits, not as many vegetables this season, because nobody to pick them. Evidently, DeSantis's immigration laws have put them in a position where there's nobody to do the work. So they're not going to invest money into planting crops that they know are just going to rot in the fields. Congratulations, DeSantis. But this is one of these weird things where you have the Republican policy of we're going to cut all this off, so nobody's going to go work in these fields. And then you're going to have those Republican areas
who are then starved for labor. How is this going to play out? Because understand, the rural communities, those are the ones that are heavily, heavily conservative, heavily Republican, heavily, well, in this moment, you know, on the Trump side. How is that going to play? Now, understand, we're in a weird moment because, you know, we all like food. We all want the crops to be picked. We all want to have an agricultural industry. But if nobody's doing the work, and trust me, you're not going to get middle-class kids to go do these kind of jobs. But when you look at this stuff, it's heartbreaking. When you see states like Arkansas, you see states like Iowa, you see these states out here, they're just going, you know what? Yeah, you know, North Carolina. We need cheap labor. We need people in the fields. And not, you know, 17-year-olds. We're talking sometimes 12 and 13. I think we're better than this. I'm not sure yet, but I think. Hope. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Got a lot to get to. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So over the weekend, I keep seeing stories. Got to keep Trump off the ballot. We're going to use Section 3 of Article 14 or the 14th Amendment. And I'm going, why? Why is it that Democrats feel the need to save the Republican Party? Why is it? Same thing when they did when they threw Marjorie Trainwreck Greene off of her committee. Look, I said then, and I'll say it again, the dumbest thing Democrats ever did, taking her off the Education Committee. Because like I said, the thing she said earlier, you know, how many taxes did they pay during the Ice Age? How did government melt the Ice Age? What? You can't be that stupid. And I said, look, keep her on the Education Committee so that you can point to her and go, we need more education funding. Exhibit A. Look at how dumb this woman is. You'd get your education funding. But no. Democrats have to feel the need to go and save the day from people like Green or people like Trump. I got to tell you, I think the only person Biden can beat in a general is Trump. So don't wish him away. But here to share some thoughts on the savior. I've asked our good friend Joe Walsh to come share some thoughts. Former Illinois Congressman, 2020 Republican presidential candidate, also host of White Flag with Joe Walsh podcast. You can find that wherever you get your favorite podcast. Joe, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it's been too long. Good to be with you, brother.
So what do you make of this? I mean, I'm frustrated that the Democrats keep trying to find a way to keep Trump off the ballot because, you know, and I'm going to take a lot of flack for this, and I probably should. But I got to tell you, I think the only person that Biden beats is Trump.
I beg to diff. I maybe you don't agree with me. I think Donald Trump is an existential threat to our democracy. So anything we can do to get rid of him, whether it's the 14th Amendment, whether it's whatever, or we just beat him at the ballot box.
That's what we do.
We have to do. I think the 14th Amendment thing is pie in the sky stuff. I don't think that's going to happen. But man, Rick, you look at every possible thing we can do to keep him from A, being the Republican nominee, and then B, getting elected.
See, I see it this way. Democrats need to have this need to save the Republican Party. Trump is the Republicans' problem right now. If they want to go and pursue the 14th Amendment, good on them. Let them do that. But I just don't see Democrats that they should be jumping in that. The place to beat Donald Trump, in my view, is at the polls. You go, you organize, you get people excited to vote, and you beat this guy at the polls. Because if you do any gimmickry, I think you have more chaos on the other side.
Well, I agree with you on this, Rick. We all got to stop hoping, wishing, and praying that something else is going to happen. I was on George Stephanopoulos over the weekend. Is stunned, he said, shocked that Biden and Trump are neck and neck. Another poll, a couple polls recently showing Trump and Biden neck and neck, and he can't understand it. He can't believe it. All of us need to wake up to these truths. Trump is going to be the nominee. He was always going to be the nominee. End of story. My party is a cult. He's the cult leader. Ain't nobody else is going to be the nominee. And by the way, he's got a damn good chance of getting reelected.
Do you think
we
so?
Need to accept? Oh yeah, Rick, we need to accept those truths so we can beat him. I hear from way too many Democrats who are in denial, who think there's no way Trump could ever win again. Bullshit.
I'm not saying there's no way, but I think with Trump, I think people are in their camps. I don't think there are as many persuadables as with other candidates, and I think Biden has a better chance of beating Trump than the others. That's how I feel. That's how I think. I don't see new Trump voters. I only see him losing people.
Again, I disagree. I think if it's Trump Biden tomorrow, Trump would be the favorite. And put aside Biden and his issues and the party's issues. In some of this latest polling, Rick, there are actually more Biden supporters who've moved to Trump than Trump supporters who've moved to Biden since 2020. And young people have really soured on Biden. I think there are real issues. One more thing I'll throw at you, Rick. These four indictments, I hear every day from Republicans and conservatives who can't stand Trump. And even they are telling me, Joe, this is BS. He's being targeted. They're going after him. I think he can play this next year in his favor. Imagine, Rick, one hung jury. Imagine he's acquitted on one of these charges next year. Yeah, he's a superhero.
No, you're not wrong there. And that is a fear in this, which is why you have the prosecutors now going back to the judge saying, hey, you know, he's tainting the jury pool with all of this social media stuff.
But this is the lay of the land. He's running for president. He's got a right to say what he wants to say and risk the consequences. All I'm saying is there are so many unknowns out there right now. Biden's age. Trump succeeding in one of these trials. I'll tell you, we need to accept the fact that the election is going to be really, really close between these two.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it's going to be a landslide. I've got some friends who think it's a landslide.
No,
I don't. I'll tell you, I love the things that Biden's been doing policy-wise. I know you'll disagree with that. He's doing a lot of the stuff that I've been wanting to see happen for decades, especially around the NLRB and the Department of Labor. But, you know, that's nuanced stuff. That's not going to really excite, other than me and a couple of people that I hang around with, that's not really going to excite the masses. I think the economy, if things turn around and keep moving in the direction that they're moving, maybe. But I'm a little more concerned about anyone else but Trump, to be honest.
Rick, such a big part of a president's job is communication.
Yeah.
And look, Biden can't do that part of his job anymore. And it shows the economy is doing better than people feel it's doing. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the president of the United States can't really consistently communicate how things are going out there.
No. And look, I've said this for the last year and have been beat up at every turn. Well, you're just beating up. No, I'm saying what is true. Biden struggles with the basic punchlines. And you need to make sure that happens, which is why I think anyone but Trump, I think people are in their camps on Trump, and anyone else, I think Biden would struggle with more. So then what, if you're the Democrats, what do you do?
If you're the Democrats, if I were advising Biden and the Democrats, all I'm talking about, and Biden began to do some of this over Labor Day, the economy, and pound Trump on the economy, pound Trump on jobs, just focus on that. If I'm Biden, I ignore all the indictments, I ignore all of Trump's legal battles, and focus on the basics of the economy every single damn day.
No, there's absolute truth in that. But now on these indictments, the weird part for me here, Joe, is, you know, I know all of my constitutional scholars and all of my, you know, my Tea Party friends who carried the Constitution around with them. This is our system. I keep hearing people saying, well, they're rigging the system. They've weaponized. This is our system. This is how you hold people accountable. Am I missing something here?
No. I would just phrase it like this. My former political party no longer believes in the rule of law. So that's what we're seeing. In 2020, to be a good Republican, you had to deny basic election results. To be a good Republican now, you have to deny the rule of law and actually fight against the justice system. My former colleagues in Congress, Rick, they're Jim Jordan and the rest, they want to hold hearings and go after the prosecutor down in Atlanta and go after Jack Smith. I mean, interfering with legal proceedings like this, using Congress to do that, it's astounding, but it's all about protecting Trump.
Now, what's interesting to me is, you know, today, obviously, Peter Navarro's trial started. You got some sentencings today that Enrico Tarrio gets 22 years. Does this land? I mean, you're talking to the conservative audiences. Does this matter to them, or is this all just part of the? No,
no.
He's shaking his head. It doesn't matter.
No, that choo-choo train left a long time ago. It's like I was on CNN with some woman yesterday, a couple days ago, who said that these indictments aren't hurting Trump. And I screamed, I said, no, they're helping him. Because the narrative is Donald Trump is a victim. He's the most persecuted person in human history. So every indictment only, Rick, only furthers that narrative. And every insurrectionist who is sentenced only furthers that narrative. It strengthens what, sadly, everybody on my right now believes, which is that, you know, the justice system is being used to go after the right, which is just a bunch of BS.
Well, I've always said, and this is where you're going to take exception to, but I'm going to say it anyway. I've always said that no one plays the victim or the martyr like a conservative. They do it so well. The left does it too. They try. They just don't do it well. The right, man, they are masters at that victimization. Maybe it's the religion thing, I don't know, but they could nail themselves to a cross like anyone.
It's some of it's the religion thing, Rick, and some of it is kind of the white man thing. A lot of white men feel like, you know, feel aggrieved and bitter because life's changing real fast. So you need somebody to blame. Right. Somebody to blame for taking that job or coming into the country or whatever. And Trump and all the demagogues on the right. And I used to do some of this. Feed that victimization. Blame somebody else. But you're right about that. Trump is. I've never seen anyone master that victimization like Trump has.
I mean, it's amazing. I sit and I watch and I go, you know, I'm often in awe of how well the right does the outrage. I mean, you know, the daily dose of outrage is incredible to me. I don't know how to do it. And I'll be very honest. I don't know how you can keep people enraged 24/7, 365 to where they're voting against their own economic interests. That's a struggle for me. But, you know, this is where we are. And I was just watching a piece on talk radio and this medium that we're part of as being a huge part of what caused that national grievance mentality. Do you agree that this medium had a big role in that?
Yes. And I've said that and publicly apologized for a number of years now because I used to do some of that. There's gold in on the right, you know that, Rick, in spreading this fear, in making primarily your white audience feel like they're being victimized. Tucker does it brilliantly. Hannity does it brilliantly. the more outraged and inflamed you can make your audience feel on the right, man, the way better you'll do ratings wise.
Yeah, no, I saw Obama's gay again, and I saw, what was the other thing that popped up that I'm going, where is this stuff coming from? Oh yeah, it's coming from Tucker and the outrage machine. That's Tucker. Where it's all coming from. And this is not good for democracy. So last line of questioning I've got for you. We have a little bit varying different opinion on the Trump thing. I think he has to be beat at the polls. I think it has to be a sound beating. I think it has to be something that the country reclaims. But do you see any way that he's going to be held off the ballot? I don't think Democrats are going to be able to do it. I think it has to come from within the Republican Party. But do you see any way he's not the nominee?
If a heart attack kills him, or a jail cell puts him away forever, that's it. And even the jail cell, well,
he can
thing,
run.
Rick, I'm shaking.
He can run from jail. Debs did, back 100 years ago. So, he could.
No, but a heart attack that felled him would definitely do it. But no, this is, Rick, 2.5 years ago, he led a violent attempt to overthrow an American election. And he's stronger now than he's ever been in that party. So nothing can break his connection with the voters of that party. He's going to be the nominee, and your audience needs to wake up to the fact that right now I think he's a better than 50-50 chance of beating Biden head on in the polls.
Wow. I put it at 50-50. You're saying better than. And you're
yes.
Right. People listening have got to wake up and understand what that means.
And do it again, Rick, and do it again. I'm so tired of this bull crap that you're not enthused about Biden. Who gives a damn how old Biden is? Donald Trump would end our democracy. I don't give a damn how old Biden is. We have to do what we did in 20, where the Rick Smiths and the Joe Walshes of the world lock arms again, and we demand everybody go vote. Because if we don't do that, all of us again, Trump will win.
Yeah, and it will be ugly because he said his only agenda is retribution.
Yes. Yes. And we've seen what that looks like because that was the House Republicans' only agenda once they took control of the House. And look at how well they're doing.
Yeah, no, excellent point. But Joe, as always, appreciate the time. You got to come back again real soon. Love the enthusiasm.
Love you, Rick Smith. Love you.
Thank you, brother. Our good friend Joe Walsh. We've got to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Ah, yes. Retribution. That's all it's going to be about. And, where Joe and I agree is there, it will be a fight. But I think Biden is the guy. I think Trump's the guy Biden can beat. I'm concerned in a whole bunch of other ways, but I think that has to happen in order for us to reclaim our democracy and reclaim a way forward. And what's frustrating is I know the retribution that's coming because they're telling us. They're already telegraphing the entire plan. In fact, the Heritage Foundation, they've got this, what are they calling it? Project 2025. This is all about ensuring that they only put in good, good conservative kind of folk
that they can control, that they have, you know, people in place who, well, are gonna be loyal to Trump, and that's the part that's kind of scary. That it's no longer about good governance. They're going to go and they're going to destroy all the federal employment, and patronage will be great again. We're going to bring back the good old days where you've got to be loyal to to whichever party, which I am completely, completely opposed to. But this is what they're already saying. And the Heritage Foundation's got a whole training scheme. They've got a whole vetting process. There's a whole bunch of stuff here that is going to, well, show your worthiness to help well, bring back some of that retribution. And that's, I got to tell you, that should, if that doesn't scare people to go, hey, I got to get out and vote. I got to register to vote. I got to plan to vote. I got to get out and vote. And I got to vote for Biden. I don't know what is. I don't know what's left. Let's go to the phones. Got Bob on line one from Silicon Valley. Bob, how are you?
I'm pretty good, but I want to add a little piece here.
Hit me.
You're talking about the way people perceive what's going on, and part of it, I think, is being shaped by our media.
Yes.
Who really want to have a horse race kind of thing, and there's basically, they commit the sin of omission. They don't want to talk about things like, words like retribution. That becomes kind of one-sided. So they want to make it like more of a horse race, and they want to say, well, this side and that side, you know, we're fair and balanced.
Yeah, both sides-ism.
Yeah, and the trouble is there's the omissions go both ways, of course, much more on the Republican side in terms of the media not calling a spade a spade.
Or a criminal a criminal.
Well, yeah, that's true. And or even talking about stuff is, say, they commit the sin of omission almost all the time. And that's the thing that bothers me, is how do you find out what's been left out when you hear a report of some sort in the news?
That's a good question.
That's the problem. I haven't got a good answer for.
I don't either. I think the more we dig in and the more we talk about things, the more we expose stuff, the better chance we've got. But ultimately, when someone tells us who they are, we should believe them. So when Trump tells me retribution is on his agenda, you know, we should believe him.
I agree. The problem is we have short memories. And if we hear that from 6 months ago or a year ago, tend to forget it, even though he said it, you know. And you're absolutely right. It's the point of, I guess you could say, the analysts in the media who say, remember he said this and then this and then this, and they tend not to want to talk about past history. They want to talk about the horse race, but not how it got there.
No, it's all anyway, about the money.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate your bringing it up, because you're one of the few people to do it.
No, I think it's important. I appreciate the call, Bob. Thank you. No, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we've got to hold people accountable for what they say and what their goals are. I mean, for me, when Trump talked about retribution and this Project 2025 that they're moving on, they're telling you what they're going to do. They're going to create a dictatorial system, an authoritative system that our government has not been. And should never be. Now, what they do, and what I find amazing, and you listen to the right voices, you listen to the bingos or bongos or whatever is Bambino, saying, "Well, you know, Joe Biden's a dictator. You know, he's moving us towards it." And you go, "Hold on, is this the same Sleepy Joe? Is this the same guy who you say can't do anything? The same guy? Are you sure?" And this is where I go back to the Mitch McConnell quote. Which is just, it's stuck in my head. There's too much government, but the government's not doing enough. And it's that mindset that, you know, he's feeble, he's demented, he's got dementia, he's old, he's all this, but he's this great, incredible mastermind who learned coding and stole elections and is single-handedly indicting Trump in all of these places. And it's how you put both of those things in one head at one time is, I don't know. It's gymnastics. It's quite impressive because it says that you're not challenging either position. You're just accepting what outrage is being thrown out there. And I fear that's bad for democracy. It's bad for our system. Now, I've taken some heat for my position on this election, and I do believe that the only way we can move forward as a country is if Trump is soundly defeated at the polls. That's my preference. If the Republicans figure out a way to keep him off the ballot, that's them doing it. I still don't think Democrats should be involved in it. Just my thought. Much like the Marjorie Taylor Greene thing, kicking her off committees. Bad idea. He's a Republican problem in the primary, but in the general, we've all got to take him on. And this is where Republicans, if they didn't want him, here's a chance for them. You know, the Chris Christies of the world, who sat by and did nothing during Trump's tenure.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Henry Enrique Tarrio, convicted of leading the group that one judge called the tip of the spear of people getting into the Capitol. He was sentenced to 22 years in prison today. And good. What I find interesting is all of the right-wing victims, all of the the martyr crowd go, 22 years, he wasn't even there. He didn't do anything. He got much worse than Stuart Rhodes, who got, I think, 18 years. And you go, well, Tarrio had a rap sheet, a very long sheet, evidently. That's what precipitated the longer sentence. Now, I love the defense of he wasn't even there. And the most popular response to that has been, you know, Osama bin Laden wasn't in New York during 9/11. Using the logic that he wasn't even there, he should have gotten off scot-free. I know it's ludicrous, it's ridiculous, but it is the argument of the right. I'm here to share some thoughts on the sentence and some of the longer sentences that have been handed down here recently. I've asked our good friend Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
So what do you think? 22 years, is that good enough? The government was asking for 33, got 22.
That's okay. I mean, it was a little bit less than asked for and a lot more than he wanted. So I think it's a decent sentence. And the other thing is about, you know, the fact that it's the consequences of conspiring to oppose the lawful movement from, you know, one president to another, and it's called elections in our country. So it doesn't matter if he broke a window in the Capitol himself. The fact that it was definitely proven, and they had a lot of proof on this, it was proven that he was behind one of the leaders of the conspiracy, and it's called sedition. So, you know, obviously, I think he got a sentence that hopefully will tell others that are still going to go through the legal process, you kind of better think about where you're headed with this.
Yeah, you know, I was reading through the sentence, and I was reading this story, and my mind went to this really mean place. And you know, I don't normally allow myself to do this, but I started thinking, I hope the guy who closes the jail door each night, you know, just tells them to stand back and stand by. Because if you remember, that's what Trump told everyone. Stand back on January 6th.
Yeah, I got you.
So there's part of me that goes, every night, that should be the response.
Well, I think he'll be thinking about a lot of things, you know, for the next 22 years. And it's federal, so you have to serve 85% of your time. Yeah. There is no parole board. I do want to point that out. You know, in order to prepare for this entire attack, he and the other leaders, they developed this command that they chose to do. They chose the time. They chose the place they were going to do this. They brought people into the fold to do this. and they were prepared to engage in, you know, any type of opposition or violence that they had to. I mean, they went in there with those ties also, you know, of
zip ties.
What,
yeah.
What were they going to do? Strap people, you know, down with those plastic ties? I mean, they were prepared to do some things,
yeah.
Including Pence is lucky. You know, he might have been hanging from somewhere.
No, you're absolutely right. But here's my question, and I keep coming back to the thing I said the night of January 6th on this show. I said, what I want is I want the people who funded this, I want the moneyed interest behind all of this, and I want the people in positions of power, the people in Congress who aided and abetted, and we haven't seen any of that stuff.
I would assume it will come out somewhere along the line with the feds. If it doesn't, that's a shame, you know.
I mean, because there were all those allegations, and maybe you remember this, there were all these allegations of, you know, I think it was Boebert and some others who gave tours the day before that were unauthorized, and there was a lot of talk around that. Whatever happened with any of that stuff?
Well, there's the problem. Nobody digs into these things. Look, as far as tours of the Capitol, and I can tell you this because I was, as you know, chairman of House Administration, I was in charge of the tours. I was in charge of the House side for the Speaker. Now, a member of, and this is so easy to find out, a member of Congress doesn't have to schedule a tour. Now, if they want to have a group take a tour without them, yes, you schedule tours. If the member goes, then absolutely no one stops the member. You can do your own private tour. You can go anywhere you want, except unless the House is in session. And when it's not in session, you can take people on the floor of the House. So those members, when I think the key point in the media is unauthorized tours. But here's where the media fails, Rick, the national media, national corporate media. They fail because, well, the story of unauthorized tours. Okay. They were most likely authorized because the member took them. National ought to start understanding the system in D.C. because then it's easy to say, okay, fine. You know, you took them on a tour, but who did you take on a tour? What was said? What did you show them? Did you take them to restricted areas that were members only?
Right.
Those are the questions that national media doesn't dig into. And you've got to have them on it or you're never going to get the answer.
Yeah, I don't think we're ever going to find any of that out, but it's just one of those things that popped into my head of, you know, I want to know who gave the tours, and I want to know if these people were part of that.
Right.
Because exactly. They had to have intimate knowledge and do reconnaissance to be able to get into the places that they got in, because they were weak points.
Well, the other thing, I don't know, I wasn't privy to the 40,000 hours. You know, I know the House side like the back of my hand. I know where the rooms are downstairs that, If I take you down there, you're going to say, oh, that if you open that door, that's probably a garbage disposal area. No, it's not. There's offices. There's things down there. So, you know, somebody, I would like them to tell me who went down below the floor of the House and what rooms did they go into there?
Yeah.
Because those rooms are normally locked. They're not authorized. And I would like to know if did somebody have a key and they were getting into rooms? I'd like to know that.
No, I'm with you.
We're never going to find it out. Maybe we will, you know, in 30 years, somebody will reveal something. But none of that has been explored. In fact, I don't even think it's been explored by the members.
Yeah, I think they're past it. I mean, that's, I just think they think, you know, the courts are taking care of it. Move on. Time for something new.
Right.
Now, I saw a story today of my congressman, Scott Perry. Scott, pardon me, Perry. Evidently, a federal appeals court has partially blocked efforts of the special counsel to be able to get inside of Perry's phone. Is this a big deal?
And what was the rationale for it?
Well, I mean, you know, Perry was, you know, involved with, what was going on January 6th? It was his
right.
idea to bring somebody in to be the acting attorney general, to be able to do some of the stuff that Trump wanted to do. I mean, Perry was front and center to a lot of what happened on January 6th.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What I mean is, what about the cell phone, though?
Well, I'm sure they wanted to get in to find texts and whatever information that were, you know, was on a phone call. You know, I assume.
Well, they seized that cell phone. Now, that was back in February.
Right.
And they seized it, and the last stories I saw on it, he had 900 some records where they knew that he was talking to executive branch officials about the presidential election, you know, et cetera. So I thought they had those.
Yeah, I just saw this and I'm going, you know, is this a loss? Is this, you know, does Perry get to walk away scot-free?
Right, because they...
No pun intended.
The stories go back to actually, I think it was, yes, it was 2022, some point in time in the fall of 2022. Then in 2023, there were additional stories about what was on the phone, and then all of a sudden, nothing.
Yeah.
And I can't put my arms around that of, you know, what happens? Somebody opened the phone. What did they find? There was mention originally in some press articles about executive correspondence between he, you know, in the White House, and then all of a sudden it's like, okay, it's gone.
Yeah, I thought you might have some inkling of an idea.
No.
'Cause I'm looking too, and I'm going, I'm not seeing
none.
Also, got to get your thoughts on Senator Sheldon Whitehouse filing an ethics complaint over the Alito interview.
No, I did not see that. What did he do?
Yeah, he's Alito questioned whether they have the right to, Congress has the power to impose rules on the Supreme Court. So he's evidently filing an ethics charge against Alito over the interview. And I would have to assume at some point over all of the things that they've pocketed over the years. I mean, the more we find out about our Supreme Court, man, they should have NASCAR patches all over their robes.
So if he's asking that they, he's asking, I guess, Roberts then to take action on the entire thing. But you're saying that Justice Alito is questioning whether he has the authority to do that?
Yeah, I mean, Alito said that there's no provision in the Constitution that gives Congress the authority to regulate the Supreme Court.
Well, that's not true. I mean, just if something's, you know, okay, there's nothing in the Constitution that directly said that Congress could create Medicare. Yeah, there's nothing in the Constitution that directly says Congress can create HUD. But there was nothing in the Constitution that said you can't. And there's nothing in that Constitution, because Congress has budgetary power and lawmaking power, there's nothing in that Constitution that says you, the Congress, shall stay away from the United States Supreme Court. There's nothing in there.
Now, what Whitehouse said, quote, was making public comments assessing the merits of a legal issue that could come before the court undoubtedly creates the very appearance of impropriety these rules are meant to protect. So he's basically saying, look, you know, we could pass a law that puts some things into place and it could come before you. And you're already saying, you know, how you would respond to this. You know, there's a problem there.
Right.
This whole infighting over the court, though, at some point, doesn't Roberts have to step forward and say, no, I'm going to, for the sake of transparency, I'm going to put some pretty strict measures into place so that we restore some faith and some value in this institution?
Well, the answer to that actually is technically should be, but the answer is no, because now, like the senator's complaint, he can file an ethics complaint. But there probably is no particular jurisdiction of filing an ethics complaint directly involving the House on the Supreme Court. However, Congress surely tomorrow morning can create, because it is a federal position paid by taxpayers, Congress can create ethics laws. They can change them on themselves. They can create them for any federal judge. They can create them for the United States Supreme Court. That's a federal judge, too. Nothing prohibits that, you know, from happening. Now, as far as your question about Roberts, let's just look at, forget the rest of what we don't know yet on other justices. I mean, look at Clarence Thomas alone. What some facts came out, about 5 or 6 weeks ago, new ones on him, right?
Oh, yeah, there have been tons of them.
Yeah, and nothing. I mean, crickets, because nobody is putting pressure upon Roberts to, you know, cough up an answer. Are you going to change things? You're going to let things sit as they are? You're going to, devise an internal code of ethics for the Supreme Court justices? you know, that prevents this type of thing in the future? And unless he's pushed or pressured, the answer is going to be no. He's not going to do anything. He's just going to say, well, you know, we took a look at it and it's okay. And we're telling him, hey, guys, you know, be a little bit more thoughtful. You know, that's where we'll end up at. If nobody hits this, I don't know why the Congress, you know, if I were the members of the Judiciary Committee, and I know that, of course, Republicans control the House, I fully understand that, but I would still make enough noise, try to do legislation, try to do floor amendments, put it together as a floor amendment to add to a bill. The Senate, they should do something through the Judiciary Committee. So unless something's done, this is just going to, quote, go away until the next story comes out.
Yeah, well, and there will be another one, because I don't think they're going to stop taking trips. I don't think they're going to stop lining their pockets. Because if you remember, when Scalia was alive, he was always complaining that he didn't think he got paid enough.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what they did, I'll stay with Thomas for a second. What he did already goes against public disclosure. It's just that nobody legally is calling him on the carpet for it.
Is there a legal standard for that? Supreme Court? I thought the Supreme Court, I didn't think there was anything to hold him accountable for.
Well, yes, they have some, they have some disclosure laws. Now, they have loopholes in those laws, you know, if it was a friend, you don't have to, you know, report this or that. But I know there are some laws, because when the Thomas story started to break, they said, well, you're supposed to report gifts. Well, they weren't gifts because he was a friend. And so he made his own loophole.
Right.
If somebody challenges it, I doubt it's a loophole.
Yeah. It's amazing how many friends you get when you get on the Supreme Court.
You know?
It's amazing.
Believe me, I'm looking at this, and you're talking to somebody that took a trip, and filed that trip. And yeah, I'll take my comeuppance, but I'm looking at this going, wow, you know, they just...
Yeah, I mean, you should, of all people in this country, of every person, the 340 million of us, you singularly should be the one most outraged.
Well, I'm here, I'm doing your show, I'm pretty happy. But yes, I think about it, and it will drive me out of my mind. That's why I don't think about it a lot. But I do think about it because, you know, Thomas just didn't file things that he was supposed to file. And again, if nobody does anything about it, then it remains the status quo.
Yeah. Finally, got to get your thoughts on the gerrymandering in Alabama. Today you had three federal judges who ruled that the Alabama legislature's recent congressional map doesn't meet what was ordered. Any thoughts?
Well, I'm just wondering of the repercussions for, you know, the federal court has, you know, went against Alabama's congressional map, you know, that they've, you know, rejected that congressional map. And it's in a case involving, you know, racial issues. And so... I think there's three judges on the panel, right?
Right.
And they have stopped Alabama from having any elections using the congressional maps because they were gerrymandered against the state's black voters. So everybody's wondering, how do you fix the map, the state legislature, ahead of the, you know, election cycle coming up? And some of the articles I read, it's kind of hilarious, actually, Rick. How can they fix the map? Well, guess what? You fix it.
You impose it.
Yes, you do a new one. It's called doing a new one. And it's not a...
Is that the official title?
Yeah, doing a new one. And it's not a practical answer for the legislature to say, well, we don't have time. It's in 2024. They can do it in a week. They have computers that do this stuff. This is not the old draw-by-hand deal. There's a computer that you can basically say, make me a minority district. Don't make me a minority district. They have computers. It's called AI, you know, and it does it.
I keep going back to my original thought. Let's just pick a random third-grade class and let them draw the maps.
Let them do it. And now, in this opinion, too,
the judges make a comment because the state of Alabama has just absolutely said, we don't care about any other court rulings. There were other prior court rulings to this. So when they say, well, we don't have time, well, you would have had time if you'd have followed the rulings that are already occurred.
Yeah. No, just like Ohio. I mean, Ohio's kind of in the same boat, aren't you?
Well, yes. My home state, the legislature, drew maps. The Ohio Supreme Court said no. And the legislature said, oh, okay, here, let's give you the map. And this time we're going to make it in green instead of blue. I mean, I'm almost accurate. They literally changed like a dot or a word and then sent it back, you know, multiple times.
Yeah, changed the file name.
Defying it. And again, it boils down to, you know, who steps in to, you know, police the place?
No.
Who does it?
We will see. But good stuff, Bob. As always, I appreciate the time. But I got to tell you, I think I'd be more angry than you.
Believe me, I've thought about it because I read these stories. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. But, you know, things happen. Depends on the moment. Depends on who's there. Depends on who they don't want to go away. And then, you know, things happen. So it's okay.
There you go. Bob, appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Our good friend Bob Ney. I'll take a quick break right back after this to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. What are your plans for Labor Day weekend? Are you going to enjoy a barbecue with family and friends? Or maybe march with your union in a parade? Do you know the history of this holiday? On this day in labor history, the year was 1882. The first Labor Day celebration took place in New York City. 10,000 workers marched in a parade from City Hall to Union Square, then uptown to 42nd Street. Afterwards, there was a picnic, concert, and speeches. The workers included in their festivities a demand for the 8-hour day. The Labor Day events were organized by the New York Central Labor Union, an umbrella group of local union representatives. Workers wanted to show the strength of the emerging labor movement and push for improvements in working conditions. By 1884, Labor Day was celebrated in 23 states. The labor movement was growing and gaining even more attention after the 1894 Pullman strike. According to the AFL-CIO, in what most historians call an election year attempt to appease workers after the federal crackdown on the Pullman strike, shortly after the strike was broken, President Grover Cleveland signed legislation making the first Monday in September Labor Day a federal holiday. Interestingly, May 1st is traditionally considered International Workers' Day. President Cleveland did not want workers commemorating such events as the Haymarket tragedy, so he proposed that the holiday take place the first Monday in September. Today, far too few people remember Labor Day's union origins. People now see Labor Day as the unofficial end of summer. In an era when labor union membership has dwindled and far too many workers are not unionized, it is a time to remember the history of this worker-inspired holiday.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So, hey, you got some lawmakers in Central Florida. Yes. Yes, it's Florida. Yeah, you know craziness is about to come. But you've got some Central Florida lawmakers who are evidently, they claim they're considering legislative, legal, and executive options because they're angry that small business owners in their towns have put rainbow decals on their windows. And this is, you know, kind of goes back to the Green Book, you know, of the 50s and 60s where black people, you know, would travel throughout the United States and had a green travel book that, you know, said, hey, you know, this place is friendly to us and we can stay there and we can eat there. And kind of that, this is just like a decal, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it is what it is. But the idea is that it's a safe place for the LGBTQ plus community. Anyone who feels threatened, they can go there and it's a safe place. Evidently, these lawmakers are angry. They want to stop the practice. And I'm going, why? Why again? And I can only come up with the fact that probably some of them are small business owners and they don't want to be singled out. They don't want people to know that they're, you know, homophobic or whatever. So they're going to make sure that you can't say I'm okay. This is, again, remember, the free speech people, the people who love the Constitution. This is them doing this. This is the people who tell us there's too much government. This is the people who love small, less intrusive government. This is those people doing this kind of thing. But are we surprised? The answer, no, of course not. We're not surprised at all. In fact, I argue this is fairly predictable because these are the people who want Sharia, Christian Sharia law. These are the folks who want really draconian policies for people that they don't agree with. And the weird thing is I came from an era where, you know, hey, you know, do your own thing, man. You know, live your life, live your best life. I guess we're moving away from that. And quickly, because these folks, and we know which side of the aisle they come from. They're the right-wing Republican Christian, you know, fanatics who want to impose their beliefs on the rest of us. Good on these small businesses. I hope they keep up the fight. And if I had a decal, I'd put one out. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Grab the podcast. Appreciate you being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.